Final seconds of the game. A chance to score, and the chance has gone begging. If your business's commerce platform keeps missing the target on golden opportunities, get the MVP you deserve. Get Shopify. Shopify is the commerce platform revolutionizing millions of businesses worldwide. Whether you're a garage entrepreneur or IPO ready, Shopify is the only tool that you need to start, run, and grow your business without the struggle. Shopify puts you in control of every sales channel. So whether you're selling signed football boots from Shopify's in-person POS system or you're vending vintage shirts on Shopify's all-in-one e-commerce platform, you are covered. And once you've reached your audience, Shopify has the internet's best converting checkout to help you turn them from browsers to buyers. What I love about Shopify is how, no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US. And Shopify is truly a global force, powering Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across over 170 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. This is Possibility, powered by Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ranks, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ranks to take your business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/ranks.
Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Hello, Rank Squad, and welcome to Ranks FC. It's your favourite football podcast. Back again and back with part two of our European Championships preview series, Euro 2024, Group C and D, coming at you here today. My name is Jack Collins. I'll be your host. Joining me, as ever, my co-host, Mr. Dean Jones. How you doing, mate?
I'm good, mate. Yeah, I mean, this is probably the episode where we talk about the winners of this tournament. So one way or another, it's quite an important one. I'm not saying I know where it's going.
Germany are going to win it in part one.
But, you know, I do rate Denmark. So that's where... but yeah, we'll get stuck into this, mate, because there's the big guns, certainly from how we're looking at things from here in London right now. Shall I go straight into England?
Let's do it. Let's start with England, shall we?
Yeah. So in Group C, England, obviously, the headline name in a group that will also include Denmark, Serbia and Slovenia. Look, I do jest, really. I mean, we're going to be doing Group D as well, which has France in it, which is why I've dressed it up as that at the start. Do I genuinely think England are going to win the Euros? No. Like, that's not... I don't think we are going to. But obviously... they can. I would have England as second or third favourites probably to win this tournament. Now, you look at the squad depth now, you look at the emerging talent, as well as some of the experienced players, the tactics they'll use, the fact that Southgate's so experienced now in tournaments. It's all there, really. There's just a couple of frailties that I'm quite concerned about. So I think the team is quite easy to pick if you want to go for a starting 11. I mean, at the moment, as we're looking ahead to the first game against Serbia, there are doubts around Harry Maguire being able to start and serious doubts about Luke Shaw even being fit enough to be there. So we saw against Bosnia on Monday night that Mark Gahey started at left centre-back and Kieran Trippier started at left-back. And I kind of see that as Southgate showing us what might be to come. It wouldn't surprise me at all if the back four for that first game is Walker, Stones, Gahey, Trippier with Jordan Pickford in goal. Now, that's fine. I think Gahey's a good player. I'm not too concerned about that. The problem with Trippier, obviously, at right back is you're not getting what you would have got from Luke Shaw or what you would have even got from Ben Chilwell going forward. And I think the fluidity then changes in the team, because you don't have the same on both sides as you would have with Walker going down the other side. So that's my first slight concern about the structure of the team and the stability. The big question mark is the midfield and who is the third figure. So Declan Rice is nailed on, Jude Bellingham's nailed on. And then it's kind of the structure of the midfield and the attack that affects who plays as the other midfielder. You could say that Rice and Bellingham play side by side and Foden goes at the top of the attack. A lot of people would like to see that. I don't expect to see that. I think it will be Bellingham as the advanced midfielder, number 10 style. Rice in the middle with a partner. My hunch is it'll be Colby Mainoo. It could be Conor Gallagher. It could even be Trent Alexander-Arnold, to be honest. It
could be Adam Wharton.
It could be Adam Wharton. He obviously is like shot onto everybody's radar in the last couple of months and played really well when he came on. I just think, like, in the order of things, he's got a long way to get up to actually start that game. But yeah, obviously, people would like to see it. I just get the feeling that Colby, obviously, recently, when he played those couple of games for England, if you want to keep the ball, he can do something quite special that I'm not sure anybody else can. And that's taking the ball in tight areas, under pressure, getting out of those areas, releasing passes in the right way. His movement from midfield is really impressive. He's quite raw, but I think the way that he's been able to emerge at Man United in a season like they had is quite admirable. So my hunch is that I would go with him, but I know that Conor Gallagher has a lot of support from Gareth Southgate. And I've said this for a while, months really, because a lot of people way back were questioning whether Gallagher would even be in the squad. And I was like, there's absolutely no doubt Gallagher will be in the squad. And I think he might even play. And that's because of his energy. The fact that he will chase down, he'll win free kicks high up the field. He'll win the ball back high up the field. He'll break up play when he has to. Technically, I think that he's a little bit underrated. I think Conor Gallagher's a really good player, to be honest with you. But that's obviously a dilemma that Southgate's got to fix. Like, who's the right person to play in each fixture? Because I actually don't think that person is a permanent fixture in the team. I think that might be one that rotates depending on who we're actually playing.
Yeah,
here.
The opposition. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that would make sense too, right?
That would make sense. Yeah, and I don't mind that at all. And then for me, you would play Bellingham as the 10, and I just expect him to play Foden out on the left, Saka on the right, and then Kane as your number 9. No, it's a pretty good team, obviously. And the good thing we've got here is depth. So I've just talked about the midfield options. If I was to look at it in terms of flaws, I don't love the defensive depth. And I think that we're probably one injury away from a problem, two injuries away from a major problem in that back line.
Yeah.
So that does cause me some concern. I know some people worry about Jordan Pickford, but I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. I like Jordan Pickford. And then obviously, when it comes to game changers, we've got an abundance of them. Whoever he ends up taking, Gordon, Grealish, Cole Palmer, and then Ollie Watkins, Ivan Toney, whoever actually figures, there's so much there that can just break down teams and change games. Again, we saw it at that Bosnia match the other day. Like, Jack Grealish hasn't had a great time of things recently at Manchester City, isn't guaranteed to be in this squad, but he can just do things at key moments in the game that are going to make a difference. And I think when you're in a group against the likes of Slovenia and Denmark and Serbia, it might just be that you've got to be patient and you start to wear them down, and then 65 minutes, you bring on a Grealish and he suddenly finds that breakthrough. Bring on Cole Palmer and he makes that breakthrough. That's what England do have. And I'm very confident that in terms of scoring goals, they'll be okay. I just don't think we'll win it. I just don't think we will. And it comes down to the fact that there just always seems to be a flaw. Even if we've got it nailed technically and we're confident of what we're seeing on the pitch, what's going on in the mind? And that's just something that's in our DNA, unfortunately. Like, we doubt ourselves as a nation. We don't have the winning mentality. We're a bit Spursy, really. You know, we, even when things are looking a bit good, we get carried away, obviously. And the reason we get carried away is because we're kind
it's
of
okay
mocking
to
it.
Get carried away.
But we're
it's
kind of mocking
right.
ourselves, you know, like a lot of the rest of the world get really annoyed when I start singing It's Coming Home, or any England fan starts singing It's Coming Home. But a lot of it is, it's excitement, but it's also in jest.
Slightly tongue-in-cheek.
I know it's probably not.
I mean, as you know, there's obviously a scale here, a sliding scale. And I do think there is an element that, like, people get overly excited and have been overly excited about England teams that in the past haven't been that good. I don't think that this is one of those times. And the problem then is because the line starts to get blurred between jest and like, oh, actually, this England team do have the capability and quality to win this tournament. And I think that when you look at the squad on paper, there's very few that stand up to it, right? Yeah. Francis does, of course. I think that for me, this Germany side is very good, and Portugal as well.
I think Portugal for me, yeah, as well.
But
yeah,
when you kind of look at it, and Spain. But on the whole, you would expect this England squad to get to the semi-finals. That's kind of where the talent
expectation
level
should, for sure.
That should be the talent level. Like, and if you lose in the semi-finals to a France or a Portugal,
yeah,
it is.
That's what
it is,
it's
going right?
to come to.
But it gets to a point where, because I think there has been jest in this in times gone by when England have majorly disappointed at tournaments, that line starts to blur between kind of like, oh, that general level of excitement about the quality of this England team and the kind of sense of, you know, I suppose just fatality within it, that you know that something bad is going to happen. I get it. Like, but I think that's why, especially in recent times, people have started to kick back against the song and whatever. And look, I think it's ridiculous. I think that Three Lions is one of the great football anthems, right? It's one of the best songs ever written for a kind of football tournament or used by fans. So there's that to consider. But the problem is that now England are good. When England were bad, it was kind of tongue-in-cheek. Now England are good, it's a bit like, oh.
Yeah, and obviously...
And
like,
that's hard to kind of find the balance on, right?
Yeah, I mean, we get to the latter stages all the time now, so there is an expectation and there is a hope. Like, I think, talking of hope, I hope that Bellingham and Foden can live their best life in this summer and actually play how they want to play. Like, I think England's best player will be Declan Rice. I have every faith in him replicating the form that he's shown for Arsenal all season for England, because I think the side allows for him to flourish. And I think that he'll be familiar enough with the setup that he can just do his thing and kind of set the tone of games. With Bellingham and Foden recreating what they've been capable of at Real Madrid and Man City, I've got less faith. And that's what I hope surprises me about this tournament, to be honest, because whichever one ends up playing in the 10, it's going to be so key to obviously unlocking doors, but also being the star of the tournament. Like, they have the potential to be the best player at the tournament if they can thrive. Southgate typically doesn't manage to work out how to do that. If he does, England do win the tournament. That's perfectly plausible. If they don't, then I just feel, again, it'll be, you know, what are we on now, about 58 years of hurt or something? Like, it'll be, the weight goes on.
Yeah, I mean, it's a funny one, isn't it? And part of me is kind of looking, and we've discussed this before, but you're kind of looking at this England side and thinking, all right, Bellingham has had an incredible season, and there's that speak of it being off the cuff, and there's so much talent in this squad, and there's so much ability when you kind of look at the individual players. Part of me is thinking, oh, is this kind of a level of being like, England will win a group game 7-0. They'll score a goal, which is 52 one-touch passes, yeah, and put it away, and then be undone by a side that are just incredibly hard to beat. And that's my kind of fear for this England side, not kind of from a fan perspective, as you know, but kind of when you look at the quality that this team has, they should be getting deep into this tournament. And the expectation is there for a reason, because when you kind of put it man for man, it's just such a good squad. And that's why it's really hard to judge where this England side are at right now, because there have been some obviously dark moments in the last couple of years. And I think post the World Cup, which obviously
was fine in terms of to go out to France, who obviously didn't win the tournament but came very close to it in a very tight game. There's no shame in that, you know. There's no kind of sense that that's a major problem. Equally, there's this kind of flip of being like, you need to be able to step over that line in order to, you have to beat one of these big teams to do it. And right now, do we have any evidence that England can do that against the best teams in the world? I'm not quite sure.
That nervousness will still be there. If we play France at this tournament, I still would expect that to be the end of the road. I would be apprehensive, nervous, a little bit excited and hopeful, but generally, I think France would go into that game being like, right, do what we've got to do. You know what England are going to do. They're going to try and get at us. They're going to try and take their moments, but ultimately they're not as good as us and they haven't got the mentality to do this. And France are just going to have that edge on England if they come head to head, which they probably will.
Well, I don't know. My question, I suppose, is Southgate going to go for broke? We've talked about this being his last tournament. Probably. It's not guaranteed, but I think this will be Gareth Southgate's last tournament in charge of England. Does he kind of go for it? Does he throw caution to the wind and try and unleash the attacking potential of this England team? And if he does, as the balance has actually got England deep in recent tournaments, go out the window?
Look, mate, I hope that in July there are images of Gareth Southgate sat on one of those lions in Trafalgar Square having champagne poured all over him. And that's how it ends. If we do win the tournament, you just walk away, don't you? And in that moment of glory, because it ain't going to get
hard to do.
Hard to do, but you should
do
it.
With a World Cup coming up,
you should still do it. You should still do it. Go while you're up. And if we don't make it, then there'll be calls for him to go, because people say, look, he just comes up short every single time. But you know, they'll get through the group. They should win the group. And this Group C is going to be more about who then manages to take second spot, because it's pretty competitive in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, let's come from the kind of group favourites to the underdogs in Group C. And I'm going to go on to Slovenia. This is just the second time that Slovenia have ever qualified for the Euros. The other time was back in 2000, although they have been to two World Cups since then, 2002 and 2010. It's a squad that's topped and tailed with talent, but I think this looks like a stretch and maybe a step too far for the Slovenians to get out of this group. That they are well-drilled, they are robustly organised by manager Matthias Kek, and it's a testament to that they were able to qualify relatively comfortably as runners-up behind Denmark in Group H. They finished 4 points clear of Finland and Kazakhstan. A draw at home against the Danes in that group, and they lost 2-1 narrowly away from home, will increase confidence that they can be competitive. And they had a 2-0 friendly win over Portugal back in March, which will raise expectations. There are some fun bits to keep an eye on as well. Noticeably, the return of cult hero Josip Ilicic. He is back, yes, ladies and gentlemen. He's fought back to fitness and form with Maribor in his homeland. And this is a great story, because when Ilicic left Atalanta, there was a lot of social media jest, I think, about the fact that he clearly just stopped playing football and was just like, I think I'm done with this. And the fact that he's been able to pull himself back from that, and it was an incredibly difficult personal circumstance around all of these things. So the fact that he is back playing football and looking back to his best is an incredible story, an incredible narrative, and he deserves all of the credit and also kind of all of the love for the way that that's panned out. So I'm absolutely delighted to see Ilicic back in this side. There's also former sporting striker Andres Spodar, who's had a decent season at Panathinaikos. The defence and the midfield are pretty workmanlike. Slovenia play a 4-4-2, but it's at the sharp ends that they have two true talismen at either end of their careers. And I think Ilicic will play a kind of bit part role. The key player for me is Jan Oblak, who will be in net here. Now, perhaps not quite at the kind of such brilliant best that he showed through the middle of his career. And I think for a long time, there was very little debate that Jan Oblak was the best goalkeeper in the world. I don't think he is quite at that level anymore. I don't think he's probably even really in that conversation anymore. But he is still an exceptional goalkeeper. And given the fact that this is an uphill challenge for them and against the group, you would imagine that Oblak is going to need to be at his absolute best in order to keep Slovenia in games and then allow them the opportunity to maybe hurt teams at the other end. And I think that he has this kind of very special opportunity. He's obviously the captain of this side. He has this very special opportunity to, this will be probably his last tournament, I think, in terms of where he's at. There's talk of him leaving Atletico Madrid and potentially going to Saudi Arabia this summer. This feels like a big moment for him to be like, this is my last hurrah. And if I could be the man that keeps us in games and allows us that opportunity to get through a group here, that will be my kind of last sign off for my country. And I think he will be so, so up for this. And I know it seems like a ridiculous comment. Everyone's up for it. It's Euros. But in terms of just where his head's at and what it means to represent his country, I can imagine that this is going to be a pretty special tournament for Jan Oblak. And then at the other end, they've got an emerging star in Benjamin Šeško, right? Who's had a very, very good campaign for RB Leipzig, who we've talked about on some of your transfer shows about the links and the interest from Premier League clubs and beyond. There's some incredible things about Šeško. He is one of those kind of all-round strikers that does a bit of everything quite well. I like the way he runs in behind. I think his performance against Real Madrid in the Champions League this season was very, very impressive and probably turned a few heads at that point. His aerial ability is absolutely insane. There have been some videos recently of his kind of vertical leap and the way that he gets up into the air. And he's absolutely incredible, the amount of airtime that Šeško gets when he does decide to kind of hang for a header. He has the ability to do things on his own, Šeško, and make things happen by himself. And there is a little bit of the Zlatan Ibrahimovic about Šeško. I know that a lot of the comparisons have been to Erling Haaland, considering the route that both have taken, the fact that he came up through that Salzburg system and then went to the Bundesliga. Those comparisons are kind of inevitable. But something about him reminds me of Zlatan rather than Haaland. And I think that there is that ability to kind of turn on a sixpence, make things happen by himself that Haaland perhaps doesn't have quite as much. That doesn't mean he's a worse player. He's not. But I think there is something about Šeško's game where that kind of intricacy mixed with his physical presence is something quite special. I don't think he's as ruthless as Haaland in front of goal. I don't think he's quite as clinical. But I do think he has more of an ability to make things happen for himself and create shooting opportunities of his own. And that's, I think, what makes him very, very special as a footballer. So at either end, they have, heroes in so many ways. And Šeško will take over from Oblak as the talisman of his country once Oblak decides that he's had enough of international football. This is an opportunity at both ends, but I do worry about the sort of bit in the middle.
Yeah, obviously. I mean, they've got a defy all odds really to get out of the group, never mind actually cause a stir at the tournament generally. But because of this opportunity whereby the four best third place teams can qualify, make it out, one win could be enough. So it's one perfect performance needed to get out of your group, and it could be enough. And that's what I would be clinging on to if I was Slovenia. I saw somebody say, that the best thing that Slovenia can hope for in this tournament is that people stop confusing him with Slovakia, right? But I think they can hope for more than that.
That's so brutal. Not even that close to each other as countries, man. Like, Slovenia is an ex-Yugoslav republic and Slovakia was part of Czechoslovakia. Like, they're not even part of the same, like, historic groups. It's wild. Wild to me.
Did make me laugh though when I heard it.
No, don't get me wrong, it's funny, but just like it's just so weird.
Yeah, obviously. But yeah, look, when it comes to the fixtures, that they won't expect to beat England, but they'll relish the occasion. And you play football for moments like that. You're in a tournament to mix it up with the big boys, and it's going to be a very, very special day for the country to be going.
First Euros in 24 years is huge.
It's huge, yeah. And yeah, I think that this is a group that has opportunity. I really do think there's opportunities here. And you're just hoping, really, that Denmark and Serbia just show some sort of flaw. And there's definitely reason to believe that both could.
Yeah, I mean, let's come on to Denmark, shall we?
Yeah, I mean, they're a very confusing team, really. I mean, I think for a lot of neutrals, they will remain to be a team that they hold admiration for, obviously the with Christian Eriksen and stuff. There's just a feeling of goodwill, I guess, is probably the best way of describing it. And they are a good team, but you look through how they've been building over the last 2 years, and they've used six different formations across 2 years. Now, on one hand, you could say, well, that's a good strength. They're unpredictable and flexible. But you could also say they've got no idea what they're doing. And I think it's possibly a bit of both. I like the attacking mindset of this team and the options that they've got. Skov Olsen down the right, Mailer down the left. And then up front, Hoyland, Jonas Vind, Poulsen. You know, there's good options here and good belief that they can score goals. But then there's obviously concern that their best players are like way too old now. Kasper Schmeichel is suddenly 37 years old.
Yeah, it's wild, isn't it?
It actually is. It actually is. I cannot believe that Kasper Schmeichel is catching up in age with me, but he is.
he's going to surpass you soon.
He's going to surpass me. He is aging crazily fast. Eriksen, 32. Kjær, 35. Delaney, 32. Even players like Højbjerg, he's only 28, but he rarely plays at the moment. So like, you don't know exactly what you can get from him. He's generally quite a trustworthy player, to be fair. But it's an intense schedule, obviously. So you never know. It's my hunch is that Denmark do come second in the group and they do manage to clinch that spot. But I don't think that everybody in Denmark shares the same optimism. Here's a quote from Thomas Graversen, ex-Denmark and Everton and Real Madrid midfielder.
I'm really glad you got Real Madrid in there, the world's weirdest transfer.
He said, so the coach is obviously Kasper Hjulmand, and he said, there is absolutely nothing new in what Kasper Hjulmand is doing. This team is crumbling, and the Euros finals is no place for a farewell party for the same old faces.
The players that he hasn't called up is wild. Like Matt O'Reilly coming off of that season for Celtic, not being in this Denmark side is criminal. The fact that Jesper Lindstrom isn't in there, all right, it wasn't a great campaign for him at Napoli. It wasn't a great campaign for many people at Napoli, but at least he adds some sort of drive in there. Philip Billing was left out. Again, had a decent campaign for Bournemouth in the bits that he's been able to play. He left out Gustav Isaksson at Lazio, who I think is a real talent and someone very, very useful. Kind of looking at it going, really? Really? Like, these are the players you've left out. And the midfielders in particular that he's brought, I'm kind of looking at going, really? Like, what at this point? We're talking about Mikkel Damsgaard, who has struggled. I mean, his last goal for Denmark was that free kick against England, right? So we're talking about someone who really hasn't been able to pull much out of the bag since, who hasn't been able to really break into the Brentford squad. For my money, the best way that Denmark can go about this, if they're playing three in the middle, is to play Morten Hjulmand, who has been absolutely phenomenal, as you know, for Sporting, alongside the Brentford pairing of Mathias Jensen and Christian Nordgaard. I think that's their strongest midfield.
They won't do it, will they?
No, absolutely not. And it's bizarre that we're talking about this, but I think O'Reilly should start, never mind being the squad. Like that's where I'm at. And I think that when you're kind of looking at these players that have been picked ahead of him, he must be thinking, Mikkel Damsgaard.
Yeah, like, well, he probably is. Yeah, I think you're right. Maybe.
So he's gone for experience, right? But we talked about this with Croatia in that there is a sense of being like, okay, they've been there, done it before. When the going gets tough, are you going to rely on those players who have, you know, delivered in international tournaments before? And I absolutely get that. But just like Croatia, there's a little bit of sense that it might be a bit dad's army. Like, it feels like this Denmark side haven't got enough of a spark. Obviously, Rasmus Højlund's in there and he's 21 years old. But on the whole, you're kind of looking at it and going, where's the excitement? Where's the drive? Where's the ability to make something new happen? Because as we know, Denmark weren't great in the last World Cup.
No, I think their first match is against Slovenia. That's a massive game. That's a massive opportunity for Slovenia too. I think they'll really be seeing that as an opportunity to get that big performance that I talked about. Because if Denmark starts slow, Slovenia have got an opportunity there to build something and raise some doubts about who does come second and possibly best third place team that comes out of this group. So that is a key match. If Denmark beats Slovenia, they're basically through to the knockouts, right? That's how important that first game is. If they don't, they're basically out. Like, I genuinely think it's that important. That first game is that important. Probably ends up 1-1 or something, but that is where I'm sat right now with Denmark. Like, they're very, very hard to judge.
I'm just really disappointed with this squad. Like, that's actually where I'm at. I'm just thinking about, you know, the amount of players coming through, the talent that's there. And I'm incredibly disappointed that he's gone for the incredibly conservative, safe option of the players who have been there and done it before, despite the fact that few of them have actually made an impact this season. Christian Eriksen has been, at best, a bit part player for Manchester United. Pierre-Emile Højbjerg has been on the verge of leaving Spurs because he hasn't played enough in terms of this season. Damsgaard has barely featured for Brentford. I'm just sort of looking at it and going, really? I mean, Thomas Delaney has gone back to Anderlecht and been able to play again. And look, credit to him for that. And that's great. But equally, you're talking about players playing at a slightly different level, right? And that's not to kind of poo-poo the Belgian league or talk about in any sort of disrespectful way. But I think when you're delivering in the way that someone like Isaksson at Lazio has, I know they're not the same kind of player, but I just struggle with looking at it and thinking, yeah, that's the right move. And I just thought that this might be a chance to refresh and reset this Denmark squad and say, yeah, thank you to that golden generation, but the time has come to move on. And now, obviously, that's going to have to be 2026. I just can't see them progressing. Well, I mean, I can see them progressing as best placed third team, but I can't see them progressing and any further than the round of 16 with the side that they currently have. So we'll see. And that takes us on Serbia. It's kind of now or never for this Serbian golden generation, in inverted commas. It's a slightly unfamiliar setting for them. Euro 2024 is the first European tournament that Serbia have qualified for as an independent nation, despite having reached four of the last five World Cups. How about that? So it's weird. You know, we talk about Slovenia. They've been to two World Cups since they've been to Euros. Serbia's first Euros since leaving, or since splitting out as an independent nation. The last time they qualified for the Euros was 2000, and they were former Republic of Yugoslavia. They got to the quarterfinals, and Savo Milosevic finished as the joint top scorer of the tournament. It seems wild for a Serbia side that have been such regulars at World Cups, isn't it? Look, qualifying relatively serene. They finished second behind Hungary, 3 points clear of their neighbours and former partners, Montenegro. Only two losses handed out by the Hungarians, who look tastier every time something like this comes up. Look, we're recording this on the Wednesday, and after recording on Tuesday and talking Hungary up, they then decided to lose to Ireland, and Ireland can't buy wins. So I wasn't sure whether to be delighted or absolutely gutted that I'd just spoken about the Hungarians in such glowing terms, and then they lost to John O'Shea's Ireland, all sorts of it. Look, Serbia's system's a little bit unpredictable, but if I had to stake a guess on it, I think they're going to play a 3-4-2-1, wing-backs Kostic and Zivkovic, given that license to roam in an attacking sense. Sasa Lukic and Ivan Ilic holding down the midfield that will allow that front five to maraud. Serbia love to cross the ball, right? And it's understandable to a point when you look at who plays up front for them. But there is a sense, I think, that they rely on it far too much and that they can become incredibly predictable. Even if you can't decide what the system's going to look like, you can see exactly what Serbia are going to try to do. When they get the ball into the final third, they try to sling it into the box for either Vlahovic or Mitrovic to get stuck into. But it does kind of mean that when teams are defending them, they're like, well, if we just block out the middle of this box, it's very difficult for you to get away a good header on goal. And it means that there is this element of being like, Serbia needs to be able to mix it up a little bit. The threat of Dusan Vlahovic off the bench might mean that they can change things up a bit, perhaps get a little bit more in behind in games where they have less of the ball. But on the whole, you kind of know what Serbia are going to try and do. What's interesting, and kind of my key player is two here, is this link between Alexander Mitrovic and Sergej Milinkovic-Savic. Now, one of the reasons that Mitrovic left Fulham for Saudi Arabia last year was money, but one of them was also the fact that he got to play alongside Milinkovic-Savic, and he was desperate to play with SMS. And throughout this campaign, obviously Mitrovic has been absolutely banging them in for fun in the Saudi league. But I think what's interesting is that year of him and Milinkovic-Savic just playing alongside each other, refining and reflecting on that relationship that they have. And if they can get firing here together, if they can start to find each other in dangerous areas, if they can get Milinkovic-Savic up tight to the striker and allow them to, you know, build on that interplay, there is a chance, I think, the Serbia fire. And if that happens, there, I don't think there are many teams that can deal with the kind of physicality and technical ability that those two can bring between them. So if that works, and if this whole year has been a ploy for them to have basically, you've spoken at length about the fact that Harry Kane had only gone to Germany to make feel very, very comfortable for playing in the Euros and being able to be comfortable in these situations. If Milinkovic-Savic and Mitrovic have basically made a gamble that they're going to play together for a year so that they have that kind of knowledge and depth of almost telepathy to be able to hurt teams at this stage, that's massive for Serbia. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see how those two perform ahead of almost anyone else. So that's the big one for Serbia. One to watch, just on a side note, Strahinja Pavlović, who plays as the left centre back in the three. Really, really good footballer. Played for a long time at RB Salzburg and has that ability. He was one of the very few bright spots, I think, in Serbia's World Cup campaign. And he's kind of going from strength to strength at club level. I think he's someone that's going to be very much interesting clubs at a higher level at this point. I think he has that ability to step up. And this is a big tournament for him to showcase himself. So I just keep an eye on him. He's a very, very interesting footballer, good technically, has a good passing range from the back, but also a bit of a brute in the air when it comes to set pieces, etc. So one of those smart little players that I think could be on the back of a big move off the back of this tournament.
Yeah, well, I hope it goes well for them, mate. And certainly you seem more optimistic than the general vibe. I've got the World Soccer Euro guide in front of me and the headline just says pessimism reigns. Confidence is low ahead of Serbia's first ever Euros appearance as an independent nation. And the only other pullout quote that they've got from the thing says, Serbian fans and media are rather pessimistic after a series of disappointing performances and results in qualifying. So
yeah, I mean, they had another disappointing result last night. They lost 2-1 to Austria. It's not done much to improve the mood, although there was a fair few key players missing for Serbia. I think they come into the back of this with very low expectations. That might help. All right, let's move on to Group D, Dean. And are you going to start with France?
I am, yeah. France, the best team at the tournament.
Good side, actually.
Not a good side, mate. They've got three good sides, and that's the problem. That is
the players that France left out would get to the quarterfinals of this tournament.
There should be a spare team just for France to just field like the loose players.
France B.
Like sometimes you go to a tournament, your team is allowed to field a B team. France should be able to do that at Euros and World Cups now because they've got too much talent. I'm scared of them. I've already said that if they play England, I don't fancy our chances at all. There are a couple of flaws that people are potentially pointing out. Right back being one of them. There's not an obvious, elite, proven international right back. But couldn't they? I'll probably play there, right? Is that the end of the world?
I mean, it's not the end of the world. I don't think it's necessarily his best position.
But I think it's best position, but probably better than option than most teams at this tournament are going to have. So that's obviously something that is in France, a narrative that could be a problem and it's been looked at for a while. Obviously as well, the fact that who leads the line for them, is Olivier Giroud going to do it at 37 years old, on the back of joining LAFC. We'll see. But what we know about this French team is that they have an incredible track record and they have a manager that just has a depth of knowledge and experience that can't be matched. Like, he hasn't always been flavour of the month, obviously, but they've just stuck with him again and again and again. And as a result of that, they've benefited. You know, when a lot of countries wouldn't have stuck with Deschamps for this long. And there was obviously that stage a few years back when it did look like he was going to go. But to be in a job since 2012 and still seem as hungry and passionate and desperate to win as he seems, it's quite incredible, really. I mean, it probably helps when you've got a batch of players like this and you feel like it can't be that hard to actually win the tournament when you've got a crop like that. And when you look at the Euros that he's been in since 2012. In 2016, they were finalists, but 2020 got knocked out in the last 16. Obviously, at the World Cup.
That was one of the wildest games of all time, right? That was the Switzerland game.
Yeah.
That was just one of the most mad games of football I think I've ever seen.
It was an incredible match. And they were kind of exposed for what they were at the time, France, but... yeah, their strengths are that there is just no drop-off, mate. Like, if they suffer an injury or a suspension, I don't think it really matters because they've got someone else that slots straight in. Like, it's just ridiculous. Like, you look through their squad list, you're like, how are all of these players French? This is insane. You know, Mannion, Areola, Hernandez, Kanyate, Koundé, Pavard, Saliba, Upamecano, Camavinga, Fofana, Griezmann, Rabiot, Tchouameni, Thuram, Zaire Emery, Koeman, Dembele, Giroud, Kolo Muani, Mbappe. Like, this is ridiculous.
Most of them boys will be there.
Most of these are going, yeah. That's why I skipped over a few that I don't think will be there.
Hernandez is injured, so he won't be there. But Teo will be.
The tail will be there. And even when you start, like, there's a list here of, like, also in contention, right? And on the list are players like Jean-Claire Todibo is being chased by Man United for, like, £40 million. Marlo Gusto is playing for Chelsea. Boubacar Kamara is at Aston Villa. Moussa Diaby has done really well at Aston Villa. And Nkunku has been injured at Chelsea. Like, they've got so many strong 11s.
Yeah, this is what we're talking about, right? That's a list of players who haven't made the French squad for various reasons. But... you're kind of talking about it as like, that's the strength they can afford to leave at home. Nobody else has this kind of value. I mean, someone you mentioned there was Olivier Giroud. And I do wonder, is this his last tournament? And how much of a role...
he's 37.
How much of a role does he play here? Because he's been so integral to everything that France have done. And over the last few years...
he has to lead it, mate. He's brilliant.
But
he's so good at it.
I agree. I think he is the player that brings everyone else into play and therefore he has to start. But equally, there is that kind of sense of being like, are you still banging the same drum? And look, for all of France's brilliance, and look, they've got to the final, as you mentioned, in numerous occasions, and they were weirdly knocked out at the last tournament. They haven't won a European championship since the year 2000. This squad... yeah. will expect to finish that drought. And rightly so, because on paper, this squad is the best at the tournament by a mile.
Yeah, exactly. And look, the team that you would probably map out quickly in your head would be that Giroud leads the line and then has a supporting cast of three around him of Mbappe, Griezmann and Ousmane Dembele. Outrageous.
Yeah, not bad.
And it's not even like the foundations behind them aren't strong. Like you... talk about some other teams and I'm like, I talked about Germany yesterday and I said, there's half a good team here because the top end I'm fine with. I think that they look great, but the bottom end might let them down in the middle. But that's not the case with France. They are as strong in every area. I mean, I'll be amazed if they don't win it, mate. Let's just be honest about it. I'll be amazed if they don't win it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a serious side. It looks like Deschamps is going to stick with Upamecano, which I think is a bit wild, considering the season that Saliba has had, and considering that Saliba and Konate feels like a kind of impossible partnership at some points. But it looks like it's going to be Upamecano there. Who else plays in that middle is going to be interesting, but... just on the whole, it's very hard to look past them, isn't it?
Yeah, I can tell you now they will be number one in this group when I was to do my predictions. I just realised I didn't do the England.
We'll do both of them at the end.
I'll do that at the end, yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right, I'm going to take us on to probably the weakest side in this group, to Poland. Michal Problets took over this Poland side back in September after a string of poor results saw Fernando Sanz fired. Polish FA put their faith in the man that's had a fair bit of success with the under 21s at youth level, changing the tack and the narrative of a side that, you know, basically had a dreadful World Cup. I think it's very easy to say it worked. Just he went unbeaten in his first six, but they then needed penalties in that playoff game against Wales to scrape into the tournament. It was pretty unconvincing. Look, Probierz likes to play with a 3-5-2 or a 3-5-1-1 formation. He floods the midfield, tries to stifle opposition teams. He does have a relatively good record in some of the cup competitions that he's played in at domestic level. So it makes sense to a point. And also, given this group in particular, I think Poland are going to need defensive solidity and, to be honest, a bit of a miracle to progress. There are obvious strengths, right? The wing-backs are strong. Roma's Nikola Zalewski is used to playing in this role after his time under Mourinho. And on the right-hand side, Przemyslaw Frankowski has had a phenomenal couple of seasons at Lens. Arsenal fans might remember his contributions against them in the Champions League earlier on this season. Lewandowski will play out front. And look, it wasn't a vintage season for the Pole at Barcelona, but his form did pick up, I think, towards the end of the campaign, right in time for this tournament. And look, his side are going to need their captain to step up if they're going to stand any chance of causing any upsets in this group. The problem isn't necessarily Lewandowski, who is obviously still an elite striker, but rather the lack of chances that this team create. Probierz has been pretty firm that results are more important than style. And even in games against weaker sides recently, Poland have really struggled to create meaningful chances. You add this to the fact that they look very vulnerable on the counter. Jan Bednarek often plays as the right-sided player in a back three. Jakub Kivior plays on the left-hand side, which I think is actually a very nice fit for him. But Bednarek is not the most mobile, and the central player in that three is not even a lock going into this tournament, which means heroics are often necessary from key players. And that's why I've put their key player as Wojciech Szczęsny, because they, a bit like Slovenia in Group C, are going to need their goalkeeper to pull off something pretty spectacular. Now, look, Szczęsny has had mostly, I think, a good season. There is obviously talk of him leaving Juve this summer. But I think over the course of this season, Juve's defensive record has been one of the things that they can look back on with an element of pride. Szczęsny's been a real part of that. He obviously saved the penalty that got them to this tournament from Dan James. He put together some impressive penalty heroics at the World Cup as well. So he has form in that area. But I do think that it's going to need to be him, and he's going to need to have an incredible, incredible group stage if Poland are going to progress out of this group. Just one to watch is Piotr Zieliński. Obviously, he hasn't played all that much for Napoli this season because of the contract standoff and the fact that he's going to be joining Inter in the summer. Now, Inter's midfield is pretty rock solid, right? And we talked about this when I was talking about Albania and Christian Aslani. It's very difficult to break into a midfield of Çalhanoğlu, Mkhitaryan and Barella. And yet Zieliński is going in here next season, assumedly he thinks he's good enough to go and start for this Inter midfield. But we don't have much of a track record to go on. Now, he did play a bit for Napoli towards the end of the season because they realized that they almost couldn't do without him. A phenomenal footballer, like a really, really special footballer, technically so gifted. I think one of the most underrated players, to be honest, in Europe. I think he's an absolutely glorious footballer. And he has an opportunity here to kind of come into that interseason on a bit of a high and be able to kind of ride in and be like, look, did you see what I delivered even in a side that weren't as good as you are right now? I'll show you what I can do in a side that's as competent as this Inter side. And I think that he needs a spark moment to just get going into this Inter campaign, or he might struggle to break into the side next season. So I'd imagine that this looks and feels like a big tournament for Piotr Zieliński. And if he has the capability, if anyone has the capability to actually change the narrative for this Polish team, and yes, while Lewandowski at one end and Szczęsny at the other are the kind of points of interest that people will flock to, I do think it's Zieliński that's going to need to really deliver in the middle of the park if Poland are going to put together some performances here.
Yeah, that's good, mate. Yeah, I agree with that. I'm going to take it straight on because their first match at the Euros is against the Netherlands. And possibilities here for Poland, if they are going to advance out of this group, that they can make their mark in this first fixture. Because it's hard to know exactly what setup we'll be getting from the Netherlands. And as a result of that, whether they leave the back door open for Poland to exploit. Now, look, Ronald Koeman, the Dutch manager, talks about understanding the expectation and the need for his team to play attractive football. He wants his team, he says, to take the initiative when it comes to games, but he's known for pragmatism, right? And
yep.
When it comes to this tournament, I think his tactics will vary because at times he'll be too scared to open up. And I think that will be to their detriment. And at other times, I'm wondering if he's actually willing to let this team off the reins or not. If he's going to let his team off the reins a bit, I feel like the first game against Poland is the time to try and do that. It's possible that they can go and really make a statement. Now, the real strength of this Dutch team is they have an abundance of defensive stars. Like, you look at them at the back and you're like, well, this team shouldn't really concede a goal. They do, but they shouldn't. Virgil van Dijk, De Vrij, Van de Ven, De Ligt, Nathan Ake, just some of the options they have centrally, right? And then they've also got the likes of Frimpong and Dumfries, Daley Blinder. You've talked about having a great season at Girona. They've got a lot of good defensive options that should set them up well. It's just a case of what Koeman does. Does he go a back three, back five, back four? He's varied between all of those. And then who does he put in front of them? Because the big fear in Holland right now is that they get turned over very quickly and easily, and they fear they have nobody that's actual job in their midfield is to stop counterattacks and that teams can just run through them. Now, look, Holland.
This is because he's picked the wrong players. And I just said this about Denmark, right? But I'm furious. Like with Denmark, I'm disappointed. I'm furious at some of the selections in this Netherlands side. One, just a point. If he doesn't play three at the back, three centre backs with wing backs, he's misusing about three of the key players in this side.
Well, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
If he doesn't go with a back three, when you have, as you said, Mickey van der Ven, De Ligt, Van Dijk, Arke, De Vrij, like, yeah. And Daley Blind, you know, as we talk about that, you're like, please, please play three at the back. I know it's not necessarily the Cruyffian style, right? And look, I'm the biggest kind of proponent of making that 4-3-3 work if you can, right? But with the players you have at your disposal, why would you not utilize a system that brings out the best in them? It doesn't make any sense for them not to play three at the back, especially if you have someone like Frimpong or Dumfries on that right-hand side, who excel at getting forward and making things happen in the final third. It makes no sense for that. And then you're talking about this player, you know, who could stop transitions. He's left Mats Wiefer at home. Like, mate, that is what he does. And you're like, okay, well, what do they want to put in front of him? Look, this is a team with an exceptional amount of talent in this central midfield area as well, right? Tijani Reinders has had a really good first campaign at Milan. Joey Vermaan's been brilliant for PSV, although I think he thrives a little bit further forward. And then you've got Frankie de Jong, whose fitness is still under the major microscope at this point, and there is worries that he's not going to be ready. Gravenberch and Jody Shelton, who's also had a good campaign at PSV. Yeah. But just to leave Mats Wiefer at home, Martin De Roon is an annoying one because he obviously got injured ahead of the Atalanta Europa League final. And I think he would have been able to do this job. But I just can't buy that once De Roon was injured, Wiefer didn't get the call up because you'd need someone of that profile in order to stop this turnover. If they get this right, this squad's as good as any, or at least the starting 11's as good as any. Yeah. I just have no faith. Yeah. I have no faith in Koeman to get this right. And I'm probably warmer on Koeman than most. I just don't think that he's done much right when it comes to this squad.
Yeah, the balance might well be off because of that omission of Wiefer, but he didn't put him in the squad. He certainly wasn't going to be starting him, was he? Look, in attack, who knows? Cody Gakpo and Memphis Depay are sure to start every game pretty much. And then,
but yeah, still no number nine, and they left Josh Zirkzee after that campaign at Bologna.
Zirkzee's not got into the squad, which seems insane. And then you've got players like Xavi Simons, who you hope can have a big tournament and support. Like Xavi Simons has literally been like on the cusp since he was like 6 years old when he moved to Spain. He's been to like the biggest clubs in Europe, Barcelona and PSG, and he's at Leipzig now, and he's been to PSV, and we've all known about him for years. We know what a talent he can be. Still only 21, but can this be his time? Like, there's potential here, but do you trust Depay to score goals? Do you trust Gakpo to score goals? Simons, Brian Brobbey. No, I don't. I don't trust him to score enough goals that you actually make a mark.
Val Veghorst still in the squad. Don't forget the big man.
I trust him, but I don't trust him.
I mean, look, I didn't mention Koopmeiners there. Koopmeiners should and I think will start in this midfield. And look, there's rumours that he's going to be at Juventus next season under Thiago Motta, which I imagine is something that will be exciting all Juventus fans on here. But I just don't think that he's got the balance of this squad right at all. Leaving, you know, even someone like Ian Maatsen, right? If you have Maatsen, then suddenly that three at the back with wing backs looks incredibly dangerous. Because if you've got Frimpong on one side and Maatsen on the other, or Dumfries on one side and Maatsen on the other, you have attacking threats from both sides, and you have that ability to maybe be able to play, you know, a striker who is a little bit more like a Depay or a Hakpo, who plays a little bit differently to perhaps your out and out number nines. But just on the whole, I'm just really confused and frustrated with the way that this Koeman side looks. And look, maybe I'll be proved wrong, but I've got a funny feeling that the Netherlands come third in this group.
Ooh. Come on in, mate, round us off.
Well, that's because Austria are super fun. They're so fun. They're great fun. Look, a comfortable qualification campaign. They came second to a very strong Belgium side. It's grown into something bigger now, to the point where I think Ralf Rangnick's Austria are now considered a serious dark horse, and one that would be even more hotly tipped if they weren't in the group of death. They've been on a steady rise for like, I don't know, 10 years. They qualified, obviously, for their first ever Euros in 2008 when they were hosts. They got to the group stages in 2016. Out of their own steam qualifying, and then the quarterfinals at Euro 2020, where they only lost to Italy after extra time. I was at that game, actually. And Austria were really, really impressive, really well drilled. But under Rangnick, they feel like they're on a different path, a different trajectory. They beat Germany 2-0 in November, in the early days of Nagelsmann's tenure. And recently, they made pretty short work of everyone's favourite dark horses, Turkey. They beat them 6-1 in March. But as you might expect from a Rangnick side, right, they play really direct football with a very high, very intense press and some smart attacking transitions. I always come back to that Rangnick quote, right, about pressing. He's like, what is a little bit of pressing? A little bit of pressing is like a little bit of pregnant. You are either pregnant or you are not. And that's how they press. Full throttle from the start. They've lost just once since November 2022 to Belgium, and that was 3-2. And they've destroyed some big teams along the way. But why I like Austria and why I think that they have the capability to really bloody some noses is that very rarely do you see a side with an absolutely crystal clear identity at international level and with players that completely and utterly suit that identity. And the influence that RB Salzburg and RB Leipzig and Hoffenheim actually have on this Austria side is crucial to the way that Rangnick wants to play, because everybody is drilled in the sense of what they're supposed to do once they lose the ball in terms of the counter press, but also in terms of what they do when they get on the ball. And they're lightning quick in terms of their transitions. And look, Rangnick has really changed the face of this Austria side. I'm really glad in some ways that he didn't take the Bayern job. One, because I don't think it fits him. And I don't think those players are going to be able to do what he would require. But also because I think he's building something quite special here. And you can see it, not just on the pitch, but off it. Because Rangnick had demanded immediately that the Austrian team stopped playing all their games in one stadium. He started taking them around the country to try and reignite interest. He has built up a fan base ahead of, you know, what is a tournament in a neighboring country that there will be a lot of fans traveling for. He has re-engaged the Austria fan base and got the interest in the national team back up to a really, really high level. And then you look at on the pitch stuff, right? And I couldn't pick a key player because I think that the midfield is ridiculously strong and it's suited to Rangnick's style. Now, they've lost a key player in Xaver Schlager, who was very much part of this midfield. But you look at the players that are going to step up to replace him, and it's probably going to be a midfield four that play in sort of a... They sort of play Sabitzer and Konrad Laimer as wide players on paper. They sort of tuck in, and this midfield is incredibly hardworking and tense. And Laimer and Sabitzer, I think, are going to play either side of Grilic and Niklas Seewald. Now, Laimer, Salzburg-Leipzig. Sabitzer, Salzburg-Leipzig. Grilic, Hoffenheim. Seewald, Salzburg. You're like, okay, where's this got to? And in front of them is Christoph Baumgartner, who's my one to watch. 24 years old, at Leipzig now. An incredibly talented footballer and has the ability to unlock defences. He's a little bit different to the rest of them in that I think his technical ability is probably a level above, but also still has that incredible work rate and ability to drop inside to make things happen in various places. And look, Romano Schmidt is another one who might feature, another youngster, a little bit more attack-minded perhaps than some of the others mentioned. He plays for Werder Bremen, signed from RB Salzburg again. So all of this team have that Red Bull DNA that Rangnick basically helped to build. Right, he helped to push this as a system. He helped design the way that Red Bull system produced players. And now he's in charge of a group of players who are incredibly well-versed in exactly what he wants from a team. Mm. And something I like about Rangnick is that, you know, another thing about that Bayern job, I think he's a kind of manager that is good at taking a club from sort of eighth to fourth rather than second to first. Yeah. I think at the very top level, players kick back a bit against Rangnick's tactics because it's based on intensity as much as anything else. But I think at this level here, with this Austria side, who won't see themselves as too good for these tactics or too talented to be putting in the effort or work rate, I think he has almost a match made in heaven. And that's why I'm so hot on this Austria side right now. Not only are their performances matching up with what we're kind of assuming they're going to be, but just the general vibe around the place is at an all-time high. The fan base is so engaged and he has really strong part everywhere apart from up top, where I still think they're a little bit weak, but I think there's enough around the rest of the team. And someone like Stefan Posch, who's had such an incredible season for Bologna, centre-back playing right-back, but he has that pace and that intensity in order to do things. I spoke about him on James Alcott's podcast on Monday, and I was talking about the fact that I watched him play against Lazio, and he absolutely pocketed Matteo Zaccagni, who is one of those players who has that standing start, Jeremy Doku kind of quick fibre twitch, ability to beat a man, you know, and get that separation. Posch was all over him from the minute go, and it was one of the best defensive performances I've seen all season. I think you match that up with someone like Max Werber, someone like Kevin Danso, who's had a good season at Lens. It doesn't feel like there's a particularly weak point in this Austria side, apart from up top. And I think they've got enough talent, goals, and creativity in other parts of this team to make up for the fact that their number nine is not an out-and-out goal scorer. I'm really high on them. I think they're excellent. And I think that even in this group, which is incredibly challenging, they are good enough to qualify.
Well, we'll see what they're made of straight away because they play France in game one. And that can kind of work as a free hit. Like, obviously, you don't want to get beaten 4-0, but I don't think they will anyway. And then you've got your next two games. You're expecting to lose to France. Everyone expects that, you know, if you get anything from that game, massive bonus, right? So if you can get something, fine. Otherwise, you've set yourselves up. You've had your first big game and then you go and win your next two and you're through. My prediction for Group D is France at one, Austria at two, Netherlands at three, Poland at four.
Netherlands qualifying as a best place.
I don't know. I don't even
know.
I think
they'll beat Poland.
I don't even know that they'll qualify as one of the best. They could be up there with Italy when I tip them to crash and burn. In Group C, by the way, England at one. I've gone Denmark at two. I gave them the benefit of the doubt. Serbia three, Slovenia four.
Yeah, I think I'd swap Serbia and Denmark, but there isn't much between them and their two sides, I think, are quite low ebb. So we'll see. We'll see. I think it's who can kick themselves out of the funk a little bit better. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens in the next two Serbia warm-up games in particular, I think, because that performance against Austria wasn't great. So, yeah, there we have it. There's groups C and D wrapped up for you. We'll be back tomorrow where we'll be doing groups E and F and rounding off this series. But for now, thank you very much to my co-host, Mr. Dean Jones.
Cheers, mate.
I've been Jack Collins. This has been Ranks FC with the second of your three Euro 2024 previews. We'll see you tomorrow to round them off. Thank you so much for listening. Take it easy, Ranks squad. Peace. Final seconds of the game. A chance to score and... the chance has gone begging. If your business's commerce platform keeps missing the target on golden opportunities, get the MVP you deserve. Get Shopify. Shopify is the commerce platform revolutionizing millions of businesses worldwide. Whether you're a garage entrepreneur or IPO ready, Shopify is the only tool that you need to start, run, and grow your business without the struggle. Shopify puts you in control of every sales channel. So whether you're selling signed football boots from Shopify's in-person POS system or you're vending vintage shirts on Shopify's all-in-one e-commerce platform, you are covered. And once you've reached your audience, Shopify has the internet's best converting checkout to help you turn them from browsers to buyers. What I love about Shopify is how, no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US. And Shopify is truly a global force, powering Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across over 170 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. This is Possibility, powered by Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ranks, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ranks to take your business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/ranks.